Matthew chapter 2 verses 19 through 23. Nazarene. The sixth talk in a series on the Gospel of Matthew was presented by Ron Julian on April 19, 2015 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, welcome to Reformation Fellowship. It's great to see you all. Today we are finishing the birth narratives in the Gospel of Matthew. I know I've said that before, but I think it's true today. In recent weeks, we have been looking at Matthew's use of the Old Testament. Four times, Matthew tells a story about the infant Jesus, and then says that something in the Old Testament is fulfilled. And as we have seen, each of those fulfillment passages is tricky to understand. So today, we're going to look at the fourth and last of these fulfillment passages in the second chapter of Matthew, and we'll try to sum up what we have seen in the first two chapters of Matthew. Our fourth fulfillment passage is in chapter 2 of Matthew. We'll start with verse 19. But when Herod died, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and go into the land of Israel, for those who sought the child's life are dead." So Joseph got up, took the child and his mother, and came into the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Then, after being warned by God in a dream, he left for the regions of Galilee and came and lived in a city called Nazareth. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophets, "He shall be called a Nazarene." Well, as I've mentioned before, the problem that we have to solve with this particular quotation from the Old Testament is that it doesn't seem to be a quotation from the Old Testament. There's no passage in the Old Testament that says, "He shall be called a Nazarene." Well, as you might imagine, scholars have debated this passage for centuries. There have been many proposals made for how to understand it, and I want to explain to you what makes the most sense to me at this point. I want to start by talking about an option that does not really make much sense to me, but an option that a number of scholars would argue for. You will see this in the literature on Matthew. They would say to me, "You are wrong, Ron. You lie. There is a passage in the Old Testament that Matthew is quoting." This passage is found in Judges 13. This is an announcement being made to the mother of Samson. It says, "For behold, you shall conceive and give birth to a son, and no razor shall come upon his head, for the boy shall be a Nazirite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel from the hands of the Philistines." Okay, so admittedly, this is not a very close match between them. Matthew uses the form, it's actually Nazorean, which means from Nazareth. Judges uses Nazirite, which means one who has consecrated himself by taking a vow. So Matthew says also, "He shall be called a Nazorean." That sounds like it might be highlighting what people will call him. Judges says he will be a Nazirite, emphasizing that Samson will be a practicing Nazirite who will not shave his head. Why would we think that there is any connection with living in the village of Nazareth and Samson being a Nazirite? We don't have any evidence that Jesus himself was a Nazirite, so how do we put that together? Well, this is not the argument that I would prefer. I don't think there is a connection, but let me make the best case for it that I can. This is the sort of thing that you might hear. Matthew says that the prophets say this? Well, Judges isn't a prophet, but it is in the section of the Old Testament that the Jews referred to as the prophets. So that might work. Matthew could be saying, I want to make a funny sort of play on words for you. Samson was a Nazirite. He consecrated himself to practice certain religious disciplines. Well, by living in Nazareth, Jesus was a Nazorean. So by a funny sort of pun, we can think of Jesus as the ultimate Samson. He is the one who truly consecrated himself to God and delivers his people. A number of scholars seem to believe that something like this is what Matthew is doing. And I suppose the main reason that they do that is that's the closest sounding verse in the Old Testament that might be what Matthew's quoting. Like I say, it's not very close, but at least it's got some of the same letters in there. So maybe that's the one that he's getting at. I prefer to take another line of thought about this passage. I don't think that is the right answer. My thinking would run more along these lines. First of all, I think we can make a good case that Matthew is not quoting a particular passage at all. That is, the reason that there is no passage that uses these exact words is because Matthew never intended to be quoting a particular passage. He is giving the general sense of what the prophet said. We have a couple of clues that that might be the case. First of all, we notice that the other three fulfillment passages in Matthew used the singular word prophet. Matthew 1:22, all this took place to fulfill what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet. Behold, the virgin shall be with child. Matthew 2:15, to fulfill what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet. Out of Egypt I called my son. Matthew 2:17 is very explicit. What had been spoken through Jeremiah, the prophet, was fulfilled. A voice was heard in Ramah. So in each of these cases, a singular prophet is mentioned, and there is a very definite quotation of a verse from that prophet. But in our passage, the plural is used to fulfill what was spoken through the prophets. It sure sounds like Matthew means to summarize what several prophets said and not just quote a particular passage. To make my second point, I need to talk grammar for a minute. I'm sure you'll love this. When we report what someone else has said, sometimes we quote their exact words, and sometimes we just describe the content of what they said. So suppose my wife goes to a parent-teacher conference about my son, Jerry. Presumably most of you here know I don't have a son, Jerry, but so I made this up. So I ask her what the teacher said. She might respond, the teacher said, quote, Jerry is not doing well. These are the teacher's exact words, at least as being reported by my wife, Jerry is not doing well. Or my wife might respond, the teacher said that Jerry is not doing well. These are not necessarily the teacher's exact words. If they were written down, we wouldn't put quotation marks around them. Instead, we often use the word that in front to indicate it. She said that Jerry wasn't doing well. The content of what the teacher said was that Jerry is not doing well, but the teacher might not have even used the words not doing well. The teacher might have used specific words that communicated that Jerry's math scores are low and that his papers are not well written. But my wife has summed up the content of the teacher's thought by saying that Jerry is not doing well. So we face that choice often when someone is reporting to us, when we're looking in the Bible and at the Greek that's involved. Is it the actual quotation of what the person's saying that is being reported to me, or is it the content of what they said that is being reported? In the other three fulfillment passages that we've been looking at, Matthew uses a construction that is quite common for indicating an exact quote of the scriptures. Matthew uses this a lot. He does this over and over and over again through Matthew. So, Matthew 1:22. Now all this took place that what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet might be fulfilled, saying, and then the quotation. Matthew 2:15. To fulfill what was spoken of by the Lord through the prophet, saying, out of Egypt I called my son. Matthew 2:17 is what had been spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled, saying, and then we have the quotation. So Matthew seems to like using this word saying to indicate that now I am about to give the explicit quotation that I was referring to. But in this passage, Matthew doesn't do that. He uses a different word. This word is often translated like our English word that, used in just the way that I was talking about a minute ago. It doesn't have to be translated that way, but it often is. So one reasonable way to translate this section might be something like this. Then after being warned by God in a dream, Joseph withdrew to the regions of Galilee and came and lived in a city called Nazareth, so that what was spoken by the prophets might be fulfilled, that he would be called a Nazarene. Okay, so rather than looking for a verse that has those words, we're looking for a combination of things spoken by the prophets that might indicate something like that. That seems to me to be a reasonable sort of expectation to have from these words. I mean, looking at the way he's done it, even before I go and look to find whether there's a particular verse that has a quotation like this, I would be prepared to find that there isn't a verse that says those particular words, because it sounds very much like he might not be intending to quote one particular thing, because, number one, he talks about the prophets, and number two, he says it in such a way that it's very likely that he doesn't mean this to be a direct quote. He's just giving the gist of what it is that was said. Now, the content then of the message of the various prophets can be described as somehow being, he will be called a Nazarene. Now, is it a problem that the word Nazarene or Nazareth never shows up in the Old Testament? So that particular idea in that form we're not going to find in the Old Testament. Well, I don't think it is necessarily a problem. So I'll give you an example. Suppose that the Bible were set in the American West, and Matthew wrote, the prophet said he would be a cowboy, but we look and the word cowboy is never used in the Old Testament. But we do see a prediction that he would wear spurs. We do see a prediction that he would participate in a long cattle drive. We do see a passage talking about his Stetson hat. So was it fair to say that the prophet said he would be a cowboy? Yes, even though they never used the word cowboy. So I hope my point is clear here, is I think it's quite fair to say that Matthew, especially if he's being a little playful with us, which I think he is, that he's basically saying, this captures the thing that I want to talk about, but you're not going to find these exact words back there. Okay, so this is the direction that my thinking is going then, is that the prophets said something that could be captured by the phrase, he will be called a Nazarene. So now let's see if we can find what that might be. For one thing, one piece that might contribute to this, the surprising fact that Jesus is from Nazareth is related to the more generally surprising fact that he is from Galilee at all. And we do see a prophet talking about the Messiah coming from Galilee. We looked at this in an earlier passage. It is found in Isaiah in the same general context as the words, behold, the virgin shall conceive. In that passage, we see that it's talking about how the Assyrians are going to conquer the northern kingdom of Israel, which is where Galilee is. The Galilee region is in the part of the northern kingdom of Israel. But in Isaiah 9, God announces good news, Isaiah 9:1. But there will be no more gloom for her who was in anguish. In earlier times, he treated the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali with contempt. But later on, he shall make it glorious by the way of the sea on the other side of Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them. So the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, this is the area of Galilee. They're going to see a great light. And what is this great light that is going to shine in Galilee? It's the Messiah. It makes it clear as it goes on in verse 6. This is a very famous passage. For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this. Okay, so it seems to me that we have here a passage that has connected the dawning of the light of the coming of the Messiah, the king who is going to sit on the throne of David, with the northern kingdom, the place that has known great sorrow and anguish because of the conquest of the Assyrians, but now this great thing is going to happen there. This is the light of the Messiah dawning in Galilee, the despised region, Galilee of the Gentiles. We know that in Jerusalem, they looked down on Galilee at the time of Jesus' life for all the reasons that we discussed several weeks ago, and yet this is indicating that the Messiah is going to make his appearance there. So this is a part of the message of the prophets, that somehow Galilee is going to play into all of this stuff. Now, what about Nazareth? Nazareth is not specifically mentioned anywhere in the Old Testament. So at this point, we're going to draw a possible deduction from a famous passage in John. There is a Galilean man named Philip, and he has become a disciple of Jesus, an early disciple of Jesus. And so he goes to another Galilean named Nathanael, and he wants to tell Nathanael about Jesus. So in John 1:45, we read, Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." Nathanael said to him, a very famous line, "Can any good thing come out of Nazareth?" So now remember, Nathanael is himself a Galilean. He's not from Judea, he's from Galilee. But even he looks down on Nazareth. There can't be anything important happening that's related to Nazareth. So we can see from this that Nazareth wouldn't have a particularly high reputation among the Jews, especially in connection with prophetic important kinds of events. Nazareth is certainly not where an important person like the Messiah would come from. Bethlehem, yes, the city where David was born. The prophets even talk about that. Jerusalem, yes. But Nazareth is an insignificant town in the insignificant region of Galilee. Some argue that this may have even become proverbial. Now, we don't really have evidence of this, but it's possible. Like today, we might say someone is a redneck or from the sticks or something like that. He's a Nazarene, indicating lowly, unimportant, insignificant origins. Once we're aware of this, we can hear the possible dismissive vibe in how Jesus is talked about throughout the Bible. He's called Jesus the Nazarene, and that may not be an entirely complimentary sort of description. It's more like Jesus from Podunkville. The sign on this cross says, "Jesus the Nazarene, King of the Jews." And we can feel the tension in that. The King of the Jews from Nazareth? Paul in Acts is called a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, the ones who follow the Nazarene. That's how they referred to Christians at this point. Christians are the ones who follow that redneck, the guy from the sticks, the Nazarene. Okay, now, so the idea would be that to say that he is a Nazarene is to say something dismissive. He's from Galilee, but he is one to be ignored and dismissed. Well, we see hints in the prophets that the Messiah would be a nobody. one who would be dismissed. Most clearly, this is found in Isaiah, in the servant songs there. For example, Isaiah 49, God is speaking to the one called the servant. And many, including myself, would understand the servant to be the Messiah in this passage. So in Isaiah 49:6, God says, "It is too small a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved ones of Israel. I will also make you a light of the nations, so that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth. Thus says the Lord, the Redeemer of Israel and its Holy One, to the despised one, to the one abhorred by the nation, to the servant of rulers. Kings will see and arise, princes will also bow down because of the Lord who is faithful, the Holy One of Israel who has chosen you." So the servant has been chosen by God to bring light to all the nations, and yet there is a period of time where this servant can be described as the despised one, the one abhorred by the nation, the servant of rulers. Ultimately, though, God will bring it about so that kings will bow down to him. Most famous of all is the discussion of the servant in Isaiah 53, and I'll just take one little part of it. Isaiah 53:1. "Who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a tender shoot, and like a root out of parched ground. He has no stately form or majesty that we should look upon him, nor appearance that we should be attracted to him. He was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And like one from whom men hide their face, he was despised, and we did not esteem him." The servant, the arm of the Lord, which in Isaiah 53 I understand to be the Messiah. This is certainly how Jesus understood Isaiah 53. So he has been sent among men, and yet the question is, who has believed the message? Who has believed this? Because this is a hard message to believe. Because he has no stately form or majesty that we should look upon him, nor appearance that we should be attracted to him. Again, he doesn't have that impressive quality that you would expect the Messiah, the arm of the Lord, to have. Not the conquering king leading an army into Jerusalem, but perhaps the kind of guy that comes from an insignificant place. He comes out from out of the boonies, like a Nazarene. Well, of all of the ways of thinking about this passage, this is the one that makes the most sense to me. The prophets indicate that the Messiah would show up in Galilee and that he would be treated as an insignificant person. Very fitting for one whose origins are in the insignificant Galilean town of Nazareth. Now, scholars also propose one further possible connection, but I'm not convinced by this one yet, but I feel like in fairness I need to report it to you so you can think about it for yourself. Once again, we look at a passage from Isaiah that is talking about the Messiah, this time Isaiah chapter 11, verse 1. "Then a shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse, and a branch from his roots will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and strength, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord." Okay, so this is one of a number of passages that refer to the Messiah as a branch, a sprout, a twig that grows up from the stump of Jesse, or from the root of Jesse, who was the father of David. And the imagery is drawing on the fact that the throne of David is going to be destroyed. There will be no more Davidic king. So we can picture Jesse, who is the father of David. It's as if his line is like a tree that has been cut and all that's left is a stump. Or it has been cut and all that's left are some roots in the ground, but the plant itself has not grown up anymore. But one day, a sprout will grow up from that stump, a branch will come up from the stump or the roots, and that's the Messiah, the Son of David. So from this kingdom and throne that has been cut off and seemingly gone, there will be a sprout, a branch that will come up, and so the Davidic line will be reestablished, and that sprout is the Messiah. By the time of the New Testament, we can find a number of examples where the literature of the time refers to the Messiah as a branch, a sprout, something like that. Okay, so why do I bring that up? What does that have to do with anything? Well, this word for branch or sprout in Isaiah 11:1, in this one passage, is the Hebrew word netzer. It has the same letters that form the name Netzarith. We do not know, but some argue that people understood the name Nazareth to mean the place of the branch, the place of the sprout, and that they understood it as referring to the Messiah. There is no evidence that that's true, but it is an assumption that this argument makes, is that that's the name of Nazareth actually has a kind of a messianic significance. So it is possible that Matthew is playing with the idea that the Messiah, the branch, has come to live in the place of the branch. It's kind of fitting that the one whom the prophets called the branch would live in a town associated with the branch. I'm not sure that I buy that argument yet, but I'm thinking about it, and I thought I probably should report it to you. So it is difficult to say with great confidence exactly what is going on with this passage, but the thing that makes the most sense to me is something like this. Here is the idea that Matthew may be trying to get across in this passage. We might expect that Jesus would live in Bethlehem, the birth city of his great father David. That's where he was born. It is near Jerusalem, which is the place, of course, most associated with the Messiah, the place where the throne of David should rightly be set up again. Joseph, Jesus' father, seems to have wanted to go back into Judea. He seems to have wanted to go back into that region where they came from when Jesus was born. But because of the dangerous political situation and a warning from God, he instead took Jesus, the Messiah, to the surprising backwater of Galilee. But is that really so surprising? Matthew is asking. The prophets had said that the Messiah would be found in Galilee, and that's where Jesus lived. The prophets had said that he would be looked down on and dismissed, and Jesus lived in a town almost proverbial for being of no importance. So it shouldn't be surprising to us that people would call the Messiah a Nazarene, somewhat derisively, because that, in essence, is the sort of thing the prophets would lead us to expect. And perhaps Matthew is also throwing in the playful idea that the prophets had said that the Messiah is the branch from the root of Jesse, and Jesus lived in the town called the place of the branch. That last one, you understand, we don't even know that that's what people thought the name Nazareth referred to. That's just speculation. Okay, so the fact that Jesus lived in Nazareth of Galilee rather than Bethlehem near Jerusalem is a big deal to Matthew. However we ultimately explain the way he's using this passage, remember, we are talking about the Messiah, the King of the world. This is the man to whom every knee will bow. This is the man who commands the angels of God. And yet, God chooses to have him start out in the most obscure regions known to the Jewish people. He's up in the north, in Galilee, and he's in Nazareth, that little village. When the Apostle Paul wrote to the Corinthians, he said, "For consider your calling, brethren, that there were not many wise according to the flesh, nor many mighty, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong." Now, in a certain way, we can say this as being true of the Messiah himself. He was not the sort of man that the world immediately recognizes as impressive. He was an obscure man from an obscure town. But if we're paying careful attention to the Old Testament, that should not surprise us. The Savior of the world was going to be a man overlooked and mistreated by the world. I think we can understand something of why God would do things this way. Our relationship with God and His Messiah is based on a choice that we must make. Each of us must decide what to do with Jesus. But that choice would be easy, almost inevitable, if Jesus were a powerful, influential man. Of course, people will align themselves with an obvious winner. Imagine that Jesus charged into Jerusalem with a great army. He throws out the Romans. Pontius Pilate is groveling on the ground in front of him. The Pharisees and Sadducees are applauding and cheering. And to throw into boot, he has long hair that's blowing in the wind and a cape and a sword at his side. And everybody's going, oh man, this guy's cool. All of the most important people are there inviting him to lavish banquets at their expensive homes. Jesus is impressive. Jesus is a player. So how are people going to respond to that? Of course they're going to follow him. I mean, what else are you going to do? He's a winner. We go for winners. But Jesus does not seek our approval based on how impressive he is from a worldly perspective. He attracts us through his wisdom and humility. He attracts us by his diagnosis of our true problem, sin and death. He attracts us by the salvation he offers, the rescue from sin and death through his shameful death on the cross. So, coming from the podunk town of Nazareth is a stumbling block for the world, but it should not be a stumbling block for us, his people. God delights in taking the obvious worldly appeal of things and throwing it away so that we must respond to the truth of what is left. And I think it's clear that Matthew has this very much in mind. The insignificance of Nazareth is very significant. This is an amazing story. Joseph, the father protector of Jesus, wants to take him to live in the birthplace of David, near Jerusalem, at the central heart of the Jewish nation, and yet God arranges it instead so that Jesus lives in the place that is the exact opposite. Jesus lives in the least significant place, the place on the fringes instead of the place at the center, and that is where his ministry begins. This is not an accident. We are called to see past the worldly insignificance of Jesus, to see instead the wisdom and salvation of God. So I think something like that is what's happening with this story about his living in Nazareth and the way Matthew is using that reference to the Old Testament. So if you'll grant me that, at least for where we are right now, I'd like to back up for a few minutes and think about these first two chapters of Matthew, the birth narratives that we've been looking at. First of all, let's see if I can try to be clear about what I think Matthew has been doing with the Old Testament. Matthew is clearly interested in what he calls fulfillment, but as we've seen, by this he typically does not mean that the Old Testament predicted something and then that prediction came true. Rather, Matthew is interested in the way that Jesus brings to their fullness the themes and promises in the Old Testament. For example, Isaiah spoke of a child who would be named Emmanuel, God is with us. This name was meant to point to that day when God would send the Messiah to rescue and redeem Israel, that he would truly be there for them on their side. Well, Jesus is the child who is himself God with us. His name does not just mean that God is with us. He is God being with us. Jesus is that Messiah who brings God's salvation. Jesus has arrived to bring about the promise inherent in the name Emmanuel, God with us. So the inherent promises and hope for the future is being filled up in the coming of Jesus. Another example, Hosea reminded Israel of the Exodus, the time when God called them out of Egypt under Moses. Out of Egypt I called my son. But Jesus has come to bring the true rescue of Israel. God drove this comparison home by sending Jesus to Egypt and then calling him out again, just as he had done with Israel. Jesus is the one who will bring about, if you will, the true Exodus. Jesus, the deliverer of Israel, has been called back to the promised land to save his people. That wonderful rescue of Israel from Egypt is now eclipsed by the even more important rescue which Jesus will bring. It has come to its fullness. The idea of God rescuing Israel has come to its fullness in Jesus and his work. This is why, just as a side note, we can think about the Last Supper, where Jesus takes the rituals of the Passover, which point back to the old deliverance under Moses that happened when they were rescued from Egypt, and he takes those elements and applies them to himself, to his body and blood, the rescue that he is bringing about. Because once again, what he is doing now is the full expression of that theme that started with the Exodus of Israel. Another example, Isaiah highlights the tragedy of the Babylonian captivity by picturing Rachel in her grave, weeping over her children as they are gathered for deportation, just miles from her tomb. But Isaiah comforts her because God is going to send his Messiah and gather Israel again. So the attempt to kill the Messiah in Bethlehem, again, just down the road from Rachel's tomb, would seem to be an even deeper tragedy. If the Messiah is lost, then Israel loses everything. And yet, the Messiah is not lost, and God will keep his promises to Israel. The attempted attack on the Messiah is the fullest expression, in one sense, of Israel's helpless state. And yet, the deliverance of the Messiah will turn out to be the full, true deliverance of Israel. Rachel can then truly be comforted. The last example, today's passage, the prophets indicate that the Messiah may be a less than impressive figure. He is going to show up in the despised area of Galilee. He is going to be unimpressive and easy to dismiss. And this time, we might say that Jesus is fulfilling this prophetic expectation in the more traditional sense. The prophets said that he would be a nobody, he'd be hanging around Galilee, and that's exactly what he turned out to be. No surprise that he ended up living in a nothing-burger Galilean town like Nazareth. Okay, another thing that I would say about the two chapters that we've been looking at, Matthew has shown us a deep interconnection between Jesus and Israel. He started out with a genealogy of Jesus that was split into three very significant parts. He clearly meant to highlight this division. The first section started with Abraham. Jesus is a son of Abraham. Jesus is the fulfillment of the promises that God would bless Israel and bless the world through Israel, the children of Abraham. The second section started with David. Jesus is a son of David. Jesus is the fulfillment of the promises that God would bless Israel through the throne of David and would bless the world through the throne of David. The third section starts with the deportation to Babylon. The Babylonian captivity seems like the end of Israel's hopes. The Babylonian captivity seems like the end of the throne of David. And yet Jesus is the one who will fulfill those hopes and reestablish that throne. And then those same ideas continue on as he keeps referring back to the Old Testament. The Isaiah passage about the virgin conceiving occurs in the context of the Assyrian destruction of the northern kingdom of Israel. And yet, the promise is made that God will still be with them, and Jesus is the fulfillment of that promise. The Hosea passage about out of Egypt I called my son is also in the context of the Assyrian destruction of the northern kingdom. God called them out of Egypt in the past, but now, because of their evil, they are being sent back into exile. And yet God promises that he will one day bring them back, and Jesus is the fulfillment of that promise. The Isaiah passage about Rachel weeping occurs in the context of the Babylonian conquest of the southern kingdom and the destruction of the throne of David. And yet God promises that he will make a new covenant with Israel. He will forgive them and give them spiritual restoration and restore the throne of David. And Jesus is the fulfillment of those promises. Even today's passage about Nazareth has its roots in the tragic history of Israel. We are told that the Messiah will appear in Galilee, but that promise appears in the context of discussing the destruction of Galilee under the Assyrians. God has treated Galilee with contempt in the past. It would seem that everything's over, but now God is going to shine the light among them. After all, why did the Jews in Jerusalem see Galilee as a lowly, insignificant place? Why is that the situation into which the Messiah comes? Because of the tragic history of the Jews, the conflicts between the tribes descended from Jacob, the conquest of the northern kingdom by Assyria. The people of Israel are lost and fragmented, alienated from each other, and yet Jesus, coming from this lowly, despised place, has come to make everything right and will ultimately gather them together as one people again. Finally, I'm struck, and I've made this point before, but I'll end by making it again. I'm struck by the role that geography plays in the story as Matthew tells it. We start in Bethlehem. It is important that we know that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Micah the prophet said that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. And yet Bethlehem is also significant because Herod tried to kill the Messiah there. And Matthew uses the proximity to Rachel's tomb to highlight the way Jesus has come to end Israel's tragedy. We then have Jesus fleeing to Egypt and then being called back to Israel again. God has deliberately done this to highlight the comparison between Israel being called from Egypt and Jesus being called from Egypt. Jesus is the true Exodus. He has come to be the true deliverance of Israel. And then we end up in Galilee. Galilee, despised by those in Jerusalem. Nazareth, despised even by those in Galilee. And yet, from this lowly beginning, Jesus will arise to conquer sin, defeat death, and rule over all creation. As Matthew will go on to tell the story, Jesus starts in Nazareth, but his story culminates in Jerusalem, where he will die and rise again in triumph. Okay, so I'm done. We're a little early, but that was really hard to figure out how to talk about. So that's all I could do. So now you can ask your questions, because I'm sure you must have questions, because I can't imagine that you possibly understood what I was talking about. So what can we do to sort this out?
Hi.
Hi there.
Would you characterize your position as a postmodern position about the ambiguity of the Bible and about how, like, I don't feel like you're retreating, but I think when I think about the way people have understood the biblical authority in general, how people have built up churches and institutions based on, we are certain that this is happening and the way it's happening. Like, would you characterize yourself as like a post-something, or like a different perspective, or, hey, I'm retreating back from this position? Or, because I have a suspicion, should you run into, I don't know, Luther, he would say you're giving up ground in some ways. He would say you're seeing ambiguities in places that you don't need to be seeing. Like, help me.
Yeah. Okay, as it happens, I'm sure that Luther might say that about any number of things I might say. I'm not sure that he would say that in this case, though. So let me step aside from this and go to something like the parables of Jesus. Okay, so Jesus is making a point, but he makes it clear that he is making his point by telling a story. And in fact, it is cryptic enough that a lot of people may not get what it is that he's saying. I fully believe that the parables are at times cryptic, and it takes some thinking to figure out what it is that exactly that Jesus was saying. You could call that ambiguous in the sense that, well, it might be this, it might be that. You kind of have to work your way through it. I don't believe that the intention was to provide something so ambiguous that I could just map whatever my thinking was onto it. That it was rather, it was more like this is something to chew on. So I don't think of that as a particularly postmodern way of thinking about things. I would say that there is a way of thinking about the authority of the Bible and various points that people make, the perspicuity of the Bible and all that kind of thing, that where our expectation is the Bible is kind of like an instruction book where I have a series of very clear statements that just tell me exactly what I'm supposed to think and what I'm supposed to do. And if it is postmodern to reject that perspective, then I'm postmodern. I think that the Bible has any number of sorts of things in it. When it tells me to love my neighbor as myself, there's something pretty clear there, although it's something that can find expression and be lived out in a lot of different ways. There's a lot to learn, but it's not particularly ambiguous what sort of thing is being talked about. A parable is more ambiguous. The sort of thing that Matthew is doing here, I think I see Matthew as basically saying, look, my expectation is that you're going to go with me on this. I am relying on a fully developed picture of things from the Old Testament, and you're not really going to understand what I'm doing with this unless you will go with me and look at that stuff. So in that sense, it is ambiguous in the sense that it is intended to be thought-provoking and something that makes me work to figure out what it is that he has in mind. But I do think that Matthew has something in mind. So what I'm looking for is the thing that he has in mind, but he wouldn't necessarily be bothered by the fact that I've spent 20 years thinking about this and I'm only now sort of confident about this one and less confident about this one and not at all sure about this one.
No, and I think the respect you're showing to Matthew is not, there's no ambiguity there. Like, and I think, and I find that attractive. I like that idea. I want to, the idea that, well, Matthew did this on purpose. Let's not assume he flubbed it or is being, right, like, you know, vague or whatever. Right. I mean, the sincerity you're approaching him himself, I totally approve. That's excellent. And why we're using ambiguous in a number of different contexts in this,
right,
conversation.
Right.
I simply was highlighting, to use the words postmodern, the antithesis of that being, well, you're kind of saying you're stretching out the point that Jesus wasn't much to look at. I mean, you're bringing this point to the Bible and to your biblical interpretation, which is, yeah, if you're looking for this great, he could have called Jesus Emmanuel, but he didn't. That was your first point kind of you made in your first day of this, mm-hmm, series. Mm-hmm. And you're drawing out that theme continually. You're saying, mm-hmm, boy, God could have cut some corners here and we would be,
right,
booking it to Easy Street. Faith,
right,
would be a matter of an SAT question at this point.
Right.
But he perpetually defeats us. He perpetually undermines that. And that's what's feeling, find that attractive, because it feels like that's pretty much how my life has looked too. Thanks. So that dynamic right there, like that, and that feels like the antithesis from like the early church fathers, the post early church fathers, all church fathers who are saying, trust me, this is easy, we got this. We'll get a bunch of guys together in a room and whoever we disagree with, we'll kick out. Like, mm-hmm, I mean, so you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think so. You understand my caution is,
yeah,
that I've just seen an awful lot of people who would applaud the sort of thing that they think that I'm doing so that they can turn around and ignore a whole bunch of stuff that they don't want to deal with. And that I just don't want to hand anybody the tools to do that. But I recognize that's a danger,
sure,
given what's actually going on. So I don't want to guard against that danger by saying, no, it's not like that. Here are the rules. But I'm not...
Well, you're in a church, so people are going to take it not that way. People are going to take it like they want the easy... I mean, you're part of religion. So the whole economy of religion is the concept that we're going to simplify this so you can sign your name to it and we can all pretend like we agree and sleep at night. So you erring on the side of, I don't know, liberality, I don't think you're in danger of that audience. Maybe some people are here dodgeballs, but I can only speak for myself. But
not,
that's my point. It's like,
I'm not sure that anyone has ever in my entire life called me liberal, so that would be an interesting statement. But
meaning is use.
Yeah, so, yeah. No, I got you.
Okay.
I got you.
Final really quick?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a semantical thing. This is about linguistics. You said a choice, a single choice. You made you use this concept of the choice, a choice about Jesus. People have to make a choice about Jesus.
I hear you emphasizing single, a
yes.
choice.
And I found that was the concern.
That I didn't.
Do you want to flesh that out so I don't have to do it?
I didn't really mean to suggest a single. I'm not a sign on the dotted line kind of guy as I think about what sort of thing faith is.
Yes.
But it is. It's a lot easier to follow the guy who's winning. That's all I'm saying, really, is that in a lot of ways, the kind of point that I'm trying to make here is for several years now, I've been leading the discussion at Gutenberg with the juniors on Kierkegaard's concluding unscientific postscript. And one of the things that I see kind of being hammered over and over again in Kierkegaard, which I really respond to, is the idea that what he wants to reject is that there's anything necessary about faith. That is, somehow the evidence is such or something is such that it's going to carry me along to this result of faith, is that I actually have to decide what I'm going to do with this. There isn't anything that can carry me along. So when I look at Jesus being born in an obscure or coming from an obscure place and people saying, who's this guy? He's from Nazareth? I mean, this is what's going on with that? I can see that as a part of this larger thing that God is doing, is that there are all these things about him that do not automatically sweep you up into faith. You have to stop and deal with that. And that's all that I was trying to get at.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ron. One thing that I really like about the direction that you're going and that I find really helpful is that it seems to me to be one more step in treating the Bible like we would treat any other book, with, of course, you giving Matthew the benefit of the doubt in these kinds of matters stands apart from how most people would think about the Bible, not like how most people in secular culture would think about the Bible. And so you're giving him a kind of authority. And
before you go any farther, remember your point, but I just want to clarify that it's true. I have a great deal of confidence in Matthew because I have come to a conclusion about the general reliability and authority of the Bible. But I just want to add that I'm in general in favor of giving authors the benefit of the doubt, even if they're not the Bible. That is, that this happens too often is that I come across something in any difficult literature, especially if it's coming from some place that I don't agree with, and I find it easy to draw uncomplimentary conclusions about the author where I'm not really giving him a chance to make his case. And I do believe in that. So even if it wasn't the Bible, I would believe in cutting Matthew more slack than a lot of scholars do anyway. But okay, so go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's great. Like what you were saying, that said kind of what I was trying to say.
Oh, okay. Better.
But another point from that is, so if we treat the Bible like we would treat any difficult literature, as opposed to either, I think, making it too easy, like what Toby's talking about, saying, well, because the impression I got growing up was basically the prophets gave us this biographical sketch of the Messiah, and all Matthew has to do is come along and point out Jesus fits it point for point. And that's what I thought the prophets were doing. Then when I actually read like them and at all, you realize that can't be what's happening. So right then it becomes difficult. And when it becomes difficult, you have the choice, do I press on because there's something here that still seems compelling, or do I dismiss it?
Mm-hmm.
And I like what you're saying because it lets it be complicated. It lets it be what any piece of literature is when you really get down to it. And it makes it more compelling, I think, because you realize this, it could be wrong, right? But it doesn't have to be true because it seems that compelling and realistic. But that's what people do when they write about somebody's life. There's no big flashing signs. This was an important event, and this had greater significance. Matthew has to, like anybody else, look back at Jesus's life. He's helped out by Jesus's teaching. He's helped out by the scripture. But he is making those connections accurately, I think. But he's making them guided by a much vaguer, well, not vague, but a much, even maybe kind of complicated, confusing picture of what the Messiah will be. but there is a sort of picture there that can guide you, and he sees that in Jesus' life. And to help us along, he points out some things with relevant passages to try to kind of bring us to the picture that he's seen. But it's not like the scripture said this, and oh, this happened, and we can, you know, and that's what I thought it was growing up. Right. And I think that your approach helps guard, like, by not making it so simple, it's not so easy to defeat. You actually have to wrestle with it. And yeah. And I think that that's probably what Matthew was doing, because that seems like what people do. Whereas the picture that you get from the Bible in most churches, it's not like we grant special license to the Bible. And if you don't do that, then it's really easy to knock it down and say, well, that doesn't make any sense. Okay, I've said enough.
I don't mean to knock anyone with this, but I think there is something at stake in an issue like this. When I first became a Christian, there was a book whose name I have forgotten now. It was Evidence That Demands a Verdict by Josh McDowell. Okay. So his approach was kind of like, look, this predicted this in the Old Testament, and it happened in Jesus' life. Now let's think about the mathematical odds. You know, what are the odds that that would happen? Now let's take this next event, and we'll look at this happened in Jesus' life. What are the odds that that would happen? Okay, so the potential problems, say, of Isaiah's thing about the virgin not being a prediction at all about the virgin birth, which is the direction I would lean right now, although I am open to the argument that goes the other way. He doesn't even address that sort of thing. It's just, look, prediction of virgin birth, here's a virgin birth, what are the odds of that? And then he takes all the odds and he works them together and he says, so the odds of all of this stuff happening are astronomical against it, so you have to believe in Jesus. I mean, if you're going to be a rational person, the math shows that you have to believe in Jesus. Well, one of the problems with that, there are many problems with that, but one of the problems is by taking that simplistic sort of approach to each of those points, someone who wants to take what he's doing seriously, say, is he really right? Am I compelled to believe in this stuff? When they start going and looking at these passages that he's saying, look at the mathematics of the odds of all this stuff happening, and you start to see the complexities that are involved, it starts to break down. And all of a sudden, it becomes kind of like, this is why Christians believe this stuff? They think that the math proves that it's the case with weak arguments about this passage and that kind of thing. So I'm not really trying to complicate anyone's life, but I actually believe that if you want to decide whether you have confidence in someone or something, that you need to look at it with clear vision. You need to see what sort of a thing is it so that I know what I'm assessing, what it is that I'm putting my confidence in or not. So I may not have accurately answered all of the questions as to how each of these passages is being used in Matthew's thinking, but I think these are the sorts of issues that we face, and something like this is most likely what he's doing, and it is helpful for us to know that so that when we've seen people a number of times raise the issue. They start reading in the Bible and they read Matthew and they look at that stuff and say, that doesn't make any sense to me. And think, Matthew is trying to impress me with the fact that the Old Testament predicted that these things would happen, but he's not impressing me. So I'm walking away because I'm not impressed. I just think it's better to look and say, well, now let's look at what sort of a thing it is. Ultimately, I don't think the place to decide whether you're going to follow Jesus is trying to sort out these passages that we're talking about here. This is the stuff that you look at and say, okay, I'm willing to put in some time thinking about what this thing is. Jesus is important enough to me that I will do that. That's the time to try to sort out questions like this, I think. Anything else?
I want you to know how much I appreciate your hard work.
Thanks.
And how much I appreciate your trepidation. The risk you're taking and the risk of being wrong or contradicted or why. It means a lot to me.
Good. Good. Thanks.
You're like the guy when I get off the boat in a foreign country and I don't speak the language and I bump into you and I realize you're an expatriate and you've lived among them for a long time. I really need your help because their language is funny and their customs is funny and I don't understand their history. And when I'm in a conversation with them, it's a lot of it's going over my head, and I need someone like you to say, what he means is, you see, they have this story that they're taught when they're little kids, and he's referring to that. And it's like, so among them, they're having a perfectly understandable conversation. Matthew shares a history and a language and an education with his audience. But I'm sitting at the table going, will someone please bring me up to speed?
Right, right. So in your analogy, I always want to be careful that I don't fall into the trap of pretending to know more than I do. I know what they're talking about, and meanwhile, I'm not quite
make the point, this is not a digital document. This is real-life human language.
Right.
And it's nuanced, and it's flexible, and it's contextually driven, and you're eavesdropping on someone else's conversation.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of hard work to get up to speed. And I think in some of the conversations that I've had with Christians who, like I used to, it was inculcated in me, as God says it, I believe it, that settles it. Okay, if that's what God says, that should settle it. Mm-hmm. You should believe it. But methinks you don't really understand what it says sometimes. And when people start to realize how hard they have to think, and how slow they have to go, and how much work it's going to entail, faithlessness shows, because it's just not worth it. And that's really frightening to me.
Yes, that can be very frightening. Let's have sympathy for a related phenomenon, which is self-doubt, which is looking at that and thinking, I don't know if I'm up to solving this problem. Yeah. That's an appropriate sort of response. I don't have to bail in my faith before God. I just recognize, I don't know that I'm going to be the guy to figure out what's going on with this. So this is why this is a project together. And I really do think of approaching the Bible, as I've said many times, as a project that God has given the church for a couple of millennia now, that we are together kind of hammering out what sort of a thing is this.
This isn't very deep or profound, but I realize that Mary and Joseph were actually from Nazareth. Mm-hmm. And so the angel spoke to Mary in Nazareth, and his mm-hmm. parents had come from this backwater place.
Yes.
And so not only did he just kind of randomly go to Nazareth, he went back to the place of his parents. He
yes.
wasn't just there. And it's interesting that Jesus, that God called Mary and Joseph also from
yes.
Nazareth. So it's
right. No, that's good. I have to admit, I'll warn you, this may not entirely be true. I can already feel it probably not happening as much next week. But I have sort of tried to force myself to concentrate on what Matthew's doing. So I have not talked a lot about, if you've read Luke and tried to reconcile it with Matthew, you can notice that we have things that overlap and things that each of them has that the other doesn't. And in Luke, we're very clear that they start in Nazareth, they go to Bethlehem because of the census, and Luke takes it as far as saying, okay, Jesus is born, they take him to temple, and, you know, then they go back to Nazareth. Okay, so Matthew doesn't say anything about them starting out in Nazareth. He starts with Jesus being born in Bethlehem. And in part, I think it highlights the geographical story that Matthew is telling. We've got Bethlehem, we've got Egypt, and then ending up in Nazareth. I mean, that's the way he wants to tell the story. He's not lying or distorting, but he's highlighting certain things. Luke, he's highlighting, he knows Mary's part of the story seemingly much more than he knows Joseph's, so he's telling about how Mary is approached by the angel and all of that kind of stuff, but the stuff afterwards, he doesn't really say much about. This is where Matthew comes in and tells the story about how they have to take off because Herod wants to kill him, and they go to Egypt, and they're in Egypt for a while, and then they come back, and then they go to Nazareth. Luke doesn't mention any of that stuff. So in teaching this stuff in Matthew, I have sort of made this decision, rather than stepping back and tell the Christmas story in this stuff, I have decided to tell Matthew's story. And so the things that you're talking about there are absolutely right. I agree with them wholeheartedly, but I know I didn't talk about them, and it's kind of a deliberate thing. It's like I'm sort of trying to, because in my past, And I'm not faulting this at all. I think it's entirely appropriate to try to look at Matthew and Luke and to try to put together how the whole thing is working. But that's always been kind of the way I've approached the Gospels, is sort of piecemeal, you know, let's take, Luke has some stuff that we would call the Sermon on the Mount or some of that material, and Matthew has that stuff, let's throw it together and see what comes of it. And that's all great stuff. But this time, I'm sort of trying to force myself to study Matthew. I want to learn about the guy who wrote this. What is he trying to do? So I am, but like I say, I'm going to violate that next week, I'm sure, and probably every week from hereafter, but that is in theory what I'm trying to do. Okay, well, thanks. Nice to see you all.